House Finance come to order. It's 1:34 p.m. on February 28, 2013. We have members present: Vice Chair Newman, Representative Thompson, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Osterman Stoltz, Representative Costello, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Holmes, and Representative Munoz. We have a quorum to business. I believe Representative Edgman is, he may not be in town today. We have a quorum to business. We have three bills today: House Bill 24, which we've heard a couple times previously, House Bill 56, House Bill 19, and House Bill 21. We'll get through as many as we can. The bill that I'm the sponsor of, House Bill 19, we'll probably hear it and then hold it. There are some fiscal issues. The government lobbyists have been out in force, so we'll make sure that there's due process on that, a doer process than they've given others. So that we'll take up House Bill 24. We've had previous testimony. The two departments haven't had a lot of questions. Minimal fiscal impacts. We probably still have it just out of a deference of a full and complete process. So we will have the department up for any if there's any other questions, and see if there's amendments, and then go through the fiscal note process is the intent. Unless there's anything that comes up, we may or may not have a motion to move the bill out, but that's the plan at this point. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing committee substitute for House Bill number 24, an act relating to self-defense and anywhere a person has a right to be. And again, Mr. Chair and members, we are only adding the words "or in any other place where a person has a right to be," which would allow you to take your same rights that you have under the Castle Doctrine with you where you have a right to be. For there was one change made in judiciary where Representative Guttenberg added the word "other" in deference to the fact that it already mentions premises where your home, your residence, or place of business. So Representative Guttenberg thought that was appropriate. We did accept that as a friendly amendment through discussions. And with that, we're ready to answer any questions if they have, Mr. Chair.
Were there any other, not to the fiscal note issues right now, were there any folks that had any questions from the Departments of Public Safety or Law or Public Defenders? We had...
Chair, I do at some point for the Department of Law.
At some point can be right now.
Okay.
Mr. Sabodny.
I didn't want to put myself first, that's all.
Okay. Put yourself on the record, and Representative Guerra will have some form of communication, hopefully a question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rick Sabodny. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Sabodny. My question relates to the difference in what would happen if this bill passes and didn't pass. And frankly, I think both sides in the public have sort of stretched what happens if we don't pass this bill and what happens if we do pass this bill. And that's why I've had such a hard time with it. And so I'm going to ask you one of the few circumstances I can think of where this bill makes a difference, and this is it. Right now, as I read 1181.330, you have a right to self-defense anywhere you or somebody else is threatened. I mean, not just in your house, but anywhere. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
All right. So the folks who say that you don't have a right to self-defense in public, I mean, that's not correct. Right?
Oh, you can ask in a less leading manner.
Do you have a right to self-defense in public, Mr. Svobodny?
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you. And then I also don't agree with the sort of parade of horribles that some of them that I've heard on the other side. So here's the circumstance that I'm wondering whether this bill affects. You're in your house. You see somebody walking by, and they look suspicious to you. You call the cops. They tell you, don't do anything. We'll come over. We'll take a look. You decide to disregard the police's advice, and you chase that person down. You think they have a knife drawn at you, maybe. They think that you've got a knife drawn at them. You both are scared. You get into a fight, and the person who left their house ends up in what they believe is self-defense, killing the person who was walking down the street. Under current law, you had a duty not to chase that person. Am I correct? You had a duty after the police told you, as long as everything is in complete safety, you can't chase that person. Under current law, you could not have chased that person and used the right to self-defense. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're going to ask him not to affirm either moral certitudes or your correctness. You can answer him yes or no questions. If you want to, that may be part of the way you ask questions, but I don't think it's fair to have people to affirm your level of certitude.
Mr. Chair, I'm asking questions, and
You are asking questions through the chair. That's correct. You can ask, once you ask yes or no's, and we're not in a courtroom here, so let's just proceed.
Through the chair, I guess I disagree with the premise in this regard. I think you have a right to chase them.
Under current law?
Under current law, yes.
And through the chair, so if the police have told you not to chase the person, we'll come deal with it. You do chase them. You think they've drawn a weapon on you. They think you've drawn a weapon on them. You end up shooting them. Under current law, have you lost the right to self-defense because you had an ability to not shoot with clear safety to yourself and others?
Through the chair, this is where, you know, the jury really decides that question. I don't think that person gets charged in this situation, assuming, and I have to assume some facts. I mean, if the person who was doing the chasing after a person he thought was a bad guy, and then thought that they were in danger of death or serious physical injury, then they would have the right to first use non-deadly force. If they thought that the force being used against them were really caught, you know, like was imminent and life-threatening, then they have a right to use deadly force against the person.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Maybe I'm wrong, but the part that's confusing to me is that under Section 335, under 335B, it's my understanding you lose the right to self-defense when you could have avoided using force with complete personal safety and complete safety as to others. So doesn't that say that if you could have avoided using personal force to complete personal safety and complete safety to others, you don't get the right to self-defense when an altercation starts later?
Through the chair, these are difficult questions, and the example you gave me, I think you have a right to use self-defense. Let me give you an example from an Alaska case that almost is exactly the same. The guy is running away. The person you said walking down the street, that person's running away, turns towards the homeowner and shoots, right? Gun jams, and then he turns around and keeps running. The court said when the, and I'm changing the facts just to meet your example, when the homeowner keeps going after the person as he's running away with a jammed gun and chases him a block and then shoots him, and then he falls on the ground and shoots him twice more, he had a duty to retreat when the guy was running away, because he could have done it in absolute safety.
Thank you, through the chair. So in that circumstance, since he didn't have to chase the person, he lost the right to self-defense, to claim self-defense? Is that correct?
Well, he through the chair, you can't just use deadly force against a person when there's not an imminent threat against you, or another person, or a robbery is occurring, or sexual assault. There's a list of offenses in the statute there. You can't just use, you have to use an amount of force that is reasonable for the circumstances, that almost always is non-deadly force, and sometimes it escalates to deadly force. Like in your example where the person threw a knife, that now we're using deadly force. So the person in your example, if knife's thrown at them, they have an immediate ability to use deadly force. But if there's a cessation here, then they need to back up under to retreat if they can do it in absolute. They know they can do it in absolute safety.
And through the chair, do things get changed if we pass this bill?
Through the chair, I think there will be circumstances that. That people, there'll be circumstances where it will make the DA's job more difficult because they're going to have to figure, it's another factor that they have to add in. Didn't retreat, but they're still going to have to, was deadly force allowed to be used at that time? We make that decision already about whether you get to use deadly force or don't have to use deadly force, but it becomes really clear if you had the ability to retreat in absolute safety.
Mr. Chair, can I just try reading the statute? Is it all right to?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Spadnier, really all I'm trying to, if there's really no difference between this bill and the current law, then we're wasting our time. But I think there probably is. I'm trying to find out what it is. That's all I'm trying to find out. So I'm looking at 1181.335B under current law. And that says, if with complete personal safety to yourself and others, so nobody else is getting beat up by a pipe, there's complete personal safety to yourself and to others, right now, if you're in a shopping mall or in public or someplace you're legally allowed to be, if with complete safety to yourself and others, you can go call the cops, you have to go call the cops. It seems to me the new bill says that exception with complete safety to yourself and others doesn't apply if you're in this new place. So are there circumstances where if we pass this bill, where with complete personal safety to yourself and others, you could have avoided conflict and could have avoided a shooting? Are there circumstances under this bill where you'll be allowed to shoot somebody even though you could have not done so with complete personal safety to yourself and others?
Through the chair, I think that's a pretty easy question in a very difficult area. But I don't think that this bill is, the first thing that a prosecutor looks at is not whether the person retreated or didn't retreat, but whether or not the amount of force was appropriate for the circumstances. You can, and so I said it was an easy answer, and I've kind of lost the question. I don't think, I'd like to try this from a different point of view, if I may, Representative Garrett, and I'm not trying to fight with you on it. I really am not. The majority, Lefebvre, wrote a treatise on criminal law, and he says this is really a question between whether or not somebody needs to retreat
how you balance the death of the person versus your ability to not run away in kind of defeat. I don't think that's real when you're talking truly about self-defense, that you really aren't getting into those situations. The question is, was there reasonable, generally, is was there a reasonable amount of force or was it excessive in defending yourself? I mean, it.
Chair, can I have one final question on this?
Yeah.
It seems to me what this bill does, and just tell me if I'm wrong, is you always have to prove that you had the right to self-defense. I mean, the people on the anti HB 24 people are wrong when they say you can just go ahead and shoot somebody. I understand that. It seems to me the difference between the current law and the new bill, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that right now, if you can avoid the search situation with complete safety to everybody, you have to avoid it, whether it's calling the cops or whatever. And under the new bill, if you're in a public place, you don't have to avoid it. You can't just go shoot the person. But instead of calling the cops because you had complete safety and everybody else had complete safety, you can go up to the person you think is suspicious. Then an altercation starts. You're worried about your own personal safety. And then you actually do get to shoot the person at that point. So the difference seems to be that instead of calling the cops, you get to go confront the person. And then if you're in sheer terror of your life, you then get to shoot the person who you otherwise would have just called the cops on. Are we getting close to the difference between the bill and the current law?
Through the chair, I think you have it right there in your last pronouncements on it. Yes, that there may be instances where people, well, reasonable people, at least I would hope reasonable people, would step back and walk away, where others are going to put themselves forward and get themselves into a situation where now the other person is being more aggressive towards them, and it escalates to where you get to use deadly force. I think that may be a result of the bill. That's true.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Representative Osterman.
Thank you. I got just a little bit confused, I think, in this conversation. Representative Guerra started talking about somebody seeing somebody outside their home and then going out and basically chasing down the street. And I'm assuming that if he's going to, probably grab his gun or whatever he did, that he was going to protect himself while he was chasing this person down the street, catches up with the person, and the person has a gun, shows a gun themselves. And then at that point in time, after the police have told you to stay in your home, you shoot them in self-defense, and that was current law. Is that correct, that you can just shoot them and chase them down the street and shoot them because they got a gun?
Through the chair, you, the homeowner, can chase somebody off your property. You can follow them down the street, even if the police told you not to. And at the point where you've confronted each other, if the person uses deadly force against you and you feel that it is necessary to protect your life, then you can use deadly force against them.
And do it legally.
Do it legally.
All right, thank you. I thought I heard you say.
Representative Newman, and then Thompson. And then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zavotny, trying to get a little bit more of my concept of where we're going on this bill for Representative Guerra's behalf. If we get into all these for instances, and I think that's why we have juries and courts, I believe. Is that your opinion?
That's
through the chair. Absolutely. I mean, we try to make judgment calls, but ultimately, if people don't agree, it's up to 12 people sitting in a jury to decide.
Okay. So earlier today, I was discussing this bill with Representative Holmes. And I said, Representative Holmes, and if she was part of a group of ladies that were out riding motorcycles.
For the record, that was his hypothetical.
You do have a motorcycle bill up later. So
the white glove riders.
This is just like law school.
Here's what we're trying to do, because Alaska's
Professor
law.
Professor Kingston, will you respond?
Because Alaska law says that you have a duty to retreat. If they were in a public place, where in a park, or where they have a place to be, a legal right to be, enjoying their time with each other. Somebody comes up that wants to cause harm, and they feel that their life is in imminent danger, and they defend themselves. It goes to court. I mean, these always go to court because it's a criminal crime that happened. Is there an opportunity for a defense attorney that's defending the person that was going to assault Representative Holmes?
Let's keep that hypothetical here.
Or a nice lady with long hair. Is there an opportunity for a defense attorney to say that the lady on the motorcycle who was being assaulted has a duty to retreat, and she did not? And so she is at fault because she did not retreat. Where there's a defense attorney for somebody who was going to cause a crime, is there an opportunity for that to happen in a court, because our laws say that you have to retreat? And with this bill would say that you have the right to defend yourself, where that would help defend an innocent person in court.
There's a question. I think you can ferret that out, Mr. Sabatini.
Well, through the chair, and it reminds me to apologize about getting so confused the other night. But all these hypotheticals, I mean, the easy answer to your question is yes, the defense attorney can raise those issues any time. But I think you're asking really a different question. Because it would be in the example that you gave, I'm assuming that the state would be prosecuting the lady with the long hair.
Yes.
Right? And the state has to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. And I can't really think of any other case where we have to disprove something beyond a reasonable doubt. Under present law, if a person didn't retreat, we could prove that they knew they could have retreated in absolute safety. Then they won't be able to ask the court. The lady's lawyer won't be able to ask the court for a self-defense instruction to go to the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson, and then Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Svobodny, thank you very much for being here. I just wanted to clarify and make sure I'm right on this, because all of the conversations on deadly force have been using a gun or shooting somebody, and I don't think it says gun anywhere in this. And wouldn't it be the same if somebody was threatening me and I took a big, large rock and threw it? It hit him in the head and killed him? Or if I was being threatened to be robbed or threatened by my life and I was riding a motorcycle and I rode the motorcycle into that person to defend myself? That's deadly force on both of those instances too, isn't it?
Through the chair. I like that hypothetical because it's easy. Yes. It's not the mechanism. It is the type of force that can cause death. That's what deadly force means. So whether you're doing it with a rock a ballpoint pen going into, you know, point into somebody's neck. I mean, it does, the instrumentality doesn't make any difference.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It reminds me of one of the great, I think they're in the Smithsonian Institute, Archie Bunker, was it All in the Family, and then he was arguing with the meathead. He said 35,000 people were killed with handguns. He said, well, would you feel better if they were all tossed out of windows instead? But there are different types of deadly force.
Yes.
So, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out how to put me on a motorcycle into my question. I can't quite figure it out. Would this be an appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, to ask the question I asked the other day about the fiscal notes?
Sure, we can, and we'll come back to those as well. But go ahead.
But while we've got Mr.
It is relevant to the discussion.
I was wondering, and I asked when you were on the phone the other day, Rick. We have a fiscal note in front of us. It's a zero fiscal note from the department. Obviously, this bill's seen different iterations over the last several years. In the past, there have been positive fiscal notes from the department. I was wondering if you could address the zero fiscal note now compared to just in light of prior versions of the fiscal note.
Through the chair, thank you for asking that question because I'm responsible for this conflict in fiscal notes. Okay, I mean, I approve the one that you have in front of you, and I approved the one last year. In the difference, there are a couple differences. First, I grew up with this law. I mean, it since I was practicing criminal law, that's been the law of this state. And I thought it was the majority law in the country. And I know I've heard Representative Newman say there's 17 states or 20 states, and different people have come up with numbers. I just looked at LaFave and Scott today, which for the rest of the committee is kind of the treatise on criminal law. And they said that the majority rule is no duty to retreat. That's not in most of the states. So, and I thought it was the other way around. So, so that's one reason that I've changed my mind. And the other that between an indefinite fiscal note and a zero fiscal note, the other reason is, from the prosecution's point of view, we're probably going to end up doing the same thing. I mean, as I was trying to get across last night, the other night, you know, these cases are still going to come in the door. They're going to come from Commissioner Masters and local law enforcement because, you know, they're still going to investigate where there's a homicide, a death, whether it's a legally justified homicide or not. They're going to leave that up to the prosecution. We're going to look at it, and so we're going to go through that. We have to go through that same process now. If there are a couple cases screened out, they're going to be few and far between because of this issue. We're screening out cases where we don't know whether it's self-defense, but we do know we can't prove it was not self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. And I know I'm coming back to that burden. It's on us to prove the negative here. I screened out years ago a murder case in Hoonah where two people ended up in a ditch, both with knife wounds, one dead and one not. And, you know, who is the... that's all I had, you know? And it got screened out. So I don't think it's going to cause more screening of cases. I don't think it's going to cause more cases to go to trial. If, you know, and I think maybe a lot of people get carried away, and I know the chair doesn't want me to bring this up, but carried away by what's going on in Florida. But that's a different system there. They don't have the issue of duty to retreat decided by the judge even before the jury's called. And I think that would add another layer if we had that type of system to a lot of cases in this state. But we don't have that system. It's still going to be the jury deciding beyond a reasonable doubt whether the state proved that it wasn't self-defense.
One follow-up.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just fascinated because, like you said, you just discovered that actually the Judiciary Retreat is not the majority role, and like you, I was under the impression that it was. Are other states that don't have a duty to retreat, they have a self-defense law. Does that, similar to ours, does that require the prosecution to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or have you gotten to that level of scrutiny?
Through the chair, yes. I mean, that's something. Yeah, that's correct.
Just curious because I didn't know that either. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Mrs. Sabatini? Why don't you stay up there? Are there any other questions for any of the other departments?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't mind asking a couple questions to Mr. Steiner if he's on board online. I don't know if he's online.
Mr. Steiner, are you online?
If he's not, Mr. Chair, that's fine.
Yeah, we've tried to keep this inclusive process. Representative Munoz.
Thank you for Mr. Sabatini. Thank you. At the last meeting when you were testifying before the committee, you said that lawyers would be kept very busy trying to determine what the right place to be is, the definition or how that would be applied. But now you're saying that might be taken care of considering what other states are doing. Could you speak to that, please?
Yes, through the chair. Yes, I did say that, and I think that is a problem here. I mean, I don't want to get into hypotheticals, but when the example of the lady with the long hair driving her motorcycle was brought up, she was in a park. Did she pay a park fee? Did she have a right to be there? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's going to add more time to the screening process or more time to the trial, but I think it's going to be a question that we're going to litigate. That'll happen at the trial, and then it'll happen on appeal. So it doesn't change my view about the fiscal note. I do think the people who have said that, who have testified that this takes out of the equation, the split second thinking. First, I disagree with that. I mean, if you're split second thinking, you don't have a time to retreat in complete safety. But now it's going to add, you got to make that decision, you eliminate that decision, but now you got a decision. Do I have a right to be in my neighbor's yard when I'm shooting at this person? Mm-hmm. Well, I think that if those are going to balance out, we're going to be litigating them, but first, these aren't the majority of the cases that we deal with. There are a small number. And second, it's going to be, they come up in serious cases, and those are the ones that go up on appeal. And I think we are going to keep lawyers busy litigating those, but we're going to be litigating those cases anyhow.
Any other questions?
With an apology, Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. No, please, go ahead. This is the process.
I'm not known for my tact, Mr. Sabatini. I think you're doing an honorable job with the bill. But I have a distinct memory 3 years ago when I heard this bill that on the part where we had the discussion about whether you have a duty to retreat in a place you're allowed to be, any place you're legally allowed to be, and I just have a transcript from that portion of the bill where one of the questioners expressed concern, and this is really just minutes, so the minutes could be wrong. Minutes are sometimes badly summarized. And I was wrong last week when I said that it was last year. It was 3 years ago. I was reading the bottom.
Two legislatures ago,
right. On that provision about this, any place you're allowed to be, one of the legislators the minutes they expressed her concern with gang violence, she offered her belief that Virginie would extend to no duty to retreat to public places such as malls and parks. She asked if this might unwittingly legalize gang violence, and Ms. Carpenter said that she agreed that the Department of Law had that concern. I have no doubt on my memory as to what the Department of Law's position was 3 years from now, and it was that this would make it harder to prosecute gang violence cases because people who inserted themselves in a violent situation that they could have avoided are both gangs are going to claim self-defense. And the argument from the Department of Law was, is it going to make it harder to prosecute gang violence? Do I have that wrong, or have you changed your opinion?
I just want to also respectfully intrude on the question, and just this is House Bill 24. The previous legislature was House Bill 80, and the bill prior to that was House Bill 381, I believe. So there are three different bills, and in your answer can also provide any discussion about if there were different iterations of the bill, Mr. Sabatini, just so the public listening knows that we may not be dealing with the same bill.
Mr. Chair, just with your indulgence, there were parts of those other bills that were different, but I was asking the question with relation to this specific part of the old bill, which is similar to the bill right now, which is duty to retreat in a public place. So am I wrong in my recollection that this no duty to retreat in a public place where you could withdraw with complete personal safety, that the department's position was a few years ago this might make it harder to prosecute gang violence?
Through the chair, I think you're right in that. I just got in this morning, but Ms. Carpinetti went, and when she heard you say that, looked at the transcript, and she recalls saying that.
And then through the chair, what's your opinion? I mean, was there any truth to the concern from 3 years ago?
I tried to.
Is that the legal term? Is it truth or is it legal validity? Truth is kind of a subjective word, and we're talking law.
Let me try a non-subjective word.
Okay. I just want it for clarity.
Thank you. Was there a reasonable basis for Ms. Carpinetti's concern a few years ago on this issue of in public places might lead to a more difficulty in prosecuting gang violence?
It's real hard for me, not reading the transcript, to know exactly what Ms. Carpinetti meant. I don't see a difference between a public place and a private place with the gang violence. Self-defense is going to be difficult in a gang violence situation. It is going to be, I think, more difficult without the duty to retreat with gangs. I mean, we're going to have, for example, if we don't know, you know, was one gang the initial aggressor and the other not, if it was mutual combat, we're going to be okay with self-defense, because you can't use, you know, you lose the right to self-defense if you're mutual aggressors. That goes back to the preceding statute 130. You use non-deadly force, and so you don't get the right to self-defense, and then you escalate it to deadly force, you still don't have it. But there's I can conceive of situations where we don't know whether or not one gang was innocently on the corner defending their turf and the other shows up to take over, and we have to, and if there were the opportunity to retreat, it would make that case easier for us to prosecute. So I think there are situations like that, defending, you know, gang turf, that is going to be more. We're going to go to trial on them anyhow, and it's going to be more difficult for us to get a conviction because we have to prove this negative beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thanks,
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of those earlier discussions, there was a bill prior. The first version of this bill was changed significantly because of concerns by Ms. Carpinetti, and so we addressed those concerns and we changed them. There was also a time, interesting enough, when Ms. Carpinetti stated that the Department of Law, when there's a situation like this, they arrest everybody. That's what she said. I checked with another member today, and she said that yes, she remembered the same conversation. that was there in law, or in judiciary, Representative Holmes. So yeah, and that they arrest everybody. And then I asked that same question to Mr. Fayette, and he said, no, they don't. So, you know, we're getting mixed signals here, too. And I guess my thing is every one of these instances needs to go in front of a jury, a judge, and be discussed. Because there's two lawyers and two different answers, I guess, the two different things. But can you get a comment on that, please? Do we just arrest everybody right now, or do we not?
Through the chair, if that's a question for me, I'll take the middle ground. I think it depends. You know, if the cops on the scene, if the police officer on the scene can figure it out, you know, they won't arrest everybody. But if you got eight guys and they got guns, they're probably going to arrest eight guys. I think there's. I'm not trying to be difficult with this committee. I just think that the hypotheticals that are just, you know, I think Ms. Carpinetti was right in saying, you know, sometimes the police arrest them all. And I think Mr. Fayette's right in saying sometimes they don't. It's going to depend upon, I would hope that police officers, when they come to a gang fight and people have got guns, they're arresting everybody right there for their safety, for the police officer's safety. And then I think Ms. Carpinetti said they straighten it out afterwards. But sometimes they can figure it out right away.
Just to follow up on that point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zavotny, so then if we had one of those persons who was defending themselves justifiably that happened to get arrested, would it be easier for him to defend his rights if this bill was passed where he says, because he has a legal right to defend himself where he has a legal right to be?
Through the chair, the answer should be yes here, but I keep saying it's not their responsibility. It's our responsibility to prove that they did not act in self-defense, and we have to do that beyond a reasonable doubt. So I mean I'm not trying to fight with you over your hypothetical, because I think it's going to be easier for the innocent person. It's going to be it's going to be more difficult for us. And I don't mean this is, I have to want to figure out a different way of saying this. It's going to be harder to convict the guy who legitimately acted in self-defense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Does anybody have any amendments to this bill? Let's go to the fiscal notes. Representative Costello, thank you for your service here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before us, we have four fiscal notes on committee substitute for House Bill 24, Judiciary. The fiscal note number one, dated February 11, 2013, is from the Department of Administration, Office of Public Advocacy, OMB component number 43. They show a zero fiscal note. Fiscal note number two, dated the same date, February 11, 2013, is from the Department of Administration. It's the allocation, the Public Defender Agency, OMB component 1631. They show a zero fiscal note. Fiscal note dated number three, dated February 11, 2013, is from the Department of Law, Criminal Justice Litigation Allocation, OMB component number 2202, zero fiscal note. Fiscal note number four, dated February 11, 2013, from the Department of Public Safety, the Alaska State Trooper Detachment's allocation, OMB component number 2325, zero fiscal note.
I'm always, are there any questions on the fiscal notes? I'm always a little dubious about zero fiscal notes on anything that's going to be new law, because government doesn't do anything that doesn't cost money, or not do anything that might save money. Although that's never reflected. One of my suppositions, it might cause less funds to be spent in the DA's office when individual political philosophies of district attorneys aren't allowed to direct cases that are self-defense, that are justifiable self-defense, because there are different philosophies that come in play. And I think that's what a lot of this bill is about. But it's difficult to even try to reflect that. But I will be critical of zero fiscal notes all around, because they very seldom are, that government does or doesn't do something, doesn't have an impact. And it's, but that. No objection to the fiscal notes. Representative Newman, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill number 24, Judiciary, version 28LS0124/U from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, the bill is moved from committee with individual recommendations and the attached four fiscal notes. We'll take a very brief at ease. House Finance, come back to order after brief at ease. It's 2:26 p.m. Still the 28th, last day of the month. I get my rent check in after this. So I've reminded you, that was our courtesy announcement for those of us that are residents here in Juneau. We have the next bill up is House Bill 19, and it's not my intent to even attempt to move this bill today. There are some concerns among some local governments. The lobbyists for local governments have been engaged in raising questions, so we will go through the bill, take questions, and see if there's public testimony. I'll introduce the bill and say this is a bill that I've thought about doing for some time, having some type of permanent registration for vehicles after a vehicle's a certain age. There was some arbitrariness. I don't think 8 years is an old vehicle, but some people do. But that was a subjective amount, picking that date. It's similar to other jurisdictions. And the other part of it is the permanent one-time registration of trailers. And both of these are optional programs. Having anybody that has a trailer, some years, if you have a boat trailer like I do, you may not ever say, just hypothetically, if the Sioux City in a drainage doesn't have any fishing opportunities, you might not get your boat out that year, and maybe forget it's not even registered. It's one of those nuisance things. The less you have to interact with government, a lot of the people I know, myself included, kind of like that idea, and a one-time deal is fine. We couldn't, within the municipality of Anchorage and nearby jurisdictions which enforced the inspection and emissions tests, that was a barrier to even trying to enact this. We followed the lead of the Golden Heart City. I led that effort through resolution, working with Commissioner Hartig, former Attorney General Sullivan, and Mayor Sullivan. Helped among others, along with others, getting rid of the IM program, the mandatory IM program, and now it makes this bill even possible for probably a little over half the state. So it is rooted in philosophy. Once government has gotten their fair share, whatever that term means, there should be a cutoff point, and gives people an opportunity to have less interactions with government, and that's there are some speculative revenue issues. We'll deal with those. That's one of the reasons I don't want to even attempt to move this bill out today. So, but for the that is my philosophical diatribe. Mr. Breeze of my staff will run through some of the technical aspects of the bill and answer questions. We also have Ms. Erickson from the Division of Motor Vehicles online, and we have at least one person from the public to testify. Please remind me so I don't forget that member of the public out there. Mr. Breeze.
Through the chair, my name is Darrell Breeze, staff representative Bill Stoltz. The CS version for HB 19 was change in transportation to remove one section, the final section of the bill, which set a maximum that the Department of Motor Vehicle, Division of Motor Vehicles collects for permanent vehicle motor vehicle registration tax. They removed that, so now that the bill as is before us does a couple things that are quite simple. First, Section 2 of the bill allows owners of vehicles, motor vehicles, non-commercial vehicles older than 8 years old, if the owner of the vehicle wants to get a permanent registration. If they go in, they would pay the basic registration fee for that vehicle, plus an extra $25 to get the permanent registration, and they would have that for as long as they own the vehicle. Permanent registration for motor vehicles is not transferable. If the vehicle is transferred, then it has to be re-registered as it currently is in statute for vehicles that are sold and transfer of ownership takes place. The permanent registration does not transfer with them. It's an option. If someone wants to register the vehicle for the two-year period as is in statute now, that stays unchanged if this passes. Section 3 addresses the senior exemption, where seniors are allowed to get one registration for motor vehicles free. This registration fee, this one free registration, can be applied if they pay the extra $25 and get the one-time or get the permanent registration fee if you're using the free registration that is offered there.
We'll get to the conflict of interest later in the process. Go ahead, Mr. Breeze.
Section 4 of the bill basically offers the same $25 permanent registration fee to owners of non-commercial trailers. The boat trailers, as the chair had mentioned earlier, snow machine trailers, horse trailers, utility trailers, as long as they're for non-commercial use, they pay the regular registration fee, and then if they want the permanent registration, they can pay the one-time $25 fee for permanent registration and obtain that. Section 5 is a remainder from when there was a IM testing in some municipalities. The legal in helping us draft this felt it was best to leave that section in there should an IM program return. It just saves the process of having to go back and put this extra $2 fee that's charged for the IM program back in statute for the administration of the IM and the testing program that's necessary for those things to take place. Without an IM program in any municipalities, there is no fee being charged to anyone for this. Section 6 addresses the motor vehicle registration tax. What is established in Section 6 is basically a base rate. Municipalities and communities in the state of Alaska have the right to establish their own motor vehicle registration tax, and 16 communities have done so. The recommendation here in Section 6 is you can adopt what's here, and some of the municipalities that have it have adopted what's in Section 6. Some, such as Municipality of Anchorage, Matsu Borough, even here in Juneau, have adopted their own fees and structures based on what they determine is necessary and is acceptable, you know, for the elected officials to pass by ordinance through their voters. Section 7 is a new section that is going to be added to statute, which basically allows municipalities to set a motor vehicle registration tax rate for vehicles registered permanently. Currently in statute, the motor vehicle registration tax rate is based on the age of the vehicle. If it's 1 year old, you pay this much, and all the way to 8 years old, and that's where it caps off. And older than eight, that's the rate you pay for as long as you own the vehicle. This allows the municipalities who see fit by ordinance through their city councils or assemblies to sit down and go, hey, we need to raise the rate for vehicles that are registered permanently for the motor vehicle registration tax. This gives them the mechanism to do that for both permanently registered motor vehicles and permanently registered trailers. To raise the rate as they deem is necessary. And that's basically the nuts and bolts of the bill. Available to answer any questions if you have them.
Why don't we bring on Ms. Erickson? That would probably be the appropriate next step. From the Department of Administration, Division of Motor Vehicles.
Good afternoon. This is Amy Erickson from the Division of Motor Vehicles.
We don't have an immediate question. But we were hoping to provide some comments based on your knowledge and experience as the longtime director of DMV.
Well, Mr. Breeze did sum up the bill well. We are responsible for the fiscal note and what the changes in revenue would be for the state, and so we're available for any questions about that.
You guys like this bill?
We are neutral on this bill.
No, that's better than Parker. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea how long, on average, people do own their vehicles? I mean, do they normally change every 2 or 3 years or keep them forever? I mean, I know I keep mine forever, but I'm just curious if that's normal.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the average age of vehicles on the road now is 13 years old.
To the chair, is there any way, though, to know how many times that vehicle might change hands? Because this is only if you keep the vehicle.
We do not keep those records, no.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious to how many senior-exempt vehicles are on the roads here in Alaska at the present time.
I don't know at the moment, sir, but I can get back to you.
Thank you.
Any other questions from Ms. Erickson? We'll go ahead and take the public testimony. We'll come back and see if there's any other ones. Again, we're not going to, there will be no motion or effort to move this bill out today. We have public testimony. Saw Ketchikan Gateway Borough. Ms. Yes. Why don't you identify yourself yes. here so I don't slaughter your name.
Sina Gubatayo, Assistant Borough Manager.
Oh, I would have had that. Go ahead. Please, go ahead.
So the Ketchikan Gateway Borough is opposed to this bill. The motor vehicle registration taxes in our borough are used to fund our junk vehicle program. Borough residents can dispose of one vehicle a year with no disposal cost. All they have to do is get it to the vendor that we use. So the vehicles then are junked and shipped south. Obviously, here in Southeast, we have a solid waste disposal issue and don't want to have to deal with these vehicles. And so we have a direct nexus between that tax and solving a problem that older vehicles cause. And that's all I had to say. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Well, I appreciate hearing. What is the population of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough?
About 13,000.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Are there any other folks out in the public or from any agencies that wish to testify? Is there anybody here in the audience that wishes to testify? We'll go ahead and close the public testimony portion. Mr. Breeze, did you have something to add? No. We will. I wanted to get to some of the other bills. I wanted people to digest the fiscal impacts. We'll have Ms. Erickson back, and there are some speculative processes that arrive at these fiscal notes, and those are worth discussion and debate. I will not attempt to amend the fiscal note. The department they're really more for illustrative purposes than any specific action. So we can have those discussions, but I don't want to miss the opportunity of letting Representative Holmes get on her motorcycle bill. So we'll set this bill aside for near future deliberations. Thank you, Mr. Breeze. Representative Holmes, we're going to bring up your bill next. It's House Bill 56, I believe.
56.
Would you like to invite your staff up?
I would love to invite he was moving to the front row. With your permission, I'd like to invite James Waldo to join us at the table. Ms. Chairman and members of the committee, I want to thank you for letting us present House Bill 56 today, the passenger vehicle rental tax bill, and thank my co-prime sponsor across here, Representative Wilson. Mr. Chairman, back in, this has to do with taxes that are charged when people rent motorcycles, and it's an attempt to help a fledgling business opportunity, tourism-related business opportunity in our state. In 2003, the legislature passed a passenger vehicle rental tax, putting a 10% rental tax on basically on rental cars. At some point during the course of that process, the legislature realized that they the definition they were using of a passenger vehicle also included RVs. So during the course of the deliberations, they actually went in and amended the bill to charge a lower rate for RVs. RVs, of course, are bigger, they're more expensive to rent, and so a 10% tax on an RV is a much bigger chunk than 10% on a passenger car. What they did not appear to have realized at the time, and there was no discussion in the record in 2003, is that motorcycles are also were also under that definition of a passenger vehicle. Now, I don't. When I think passenger vehicle, I know you can put passengers on a motorcycle, but I don't really think of them that way. So I think it escaped the notice of the legislature at the time. In fact, appears to have escaped the notice of our tax division up until recently. Either they didn't realize motorcycles were included in this tax, or they didn't realize motorcycles were being rented in the state. In any event, about 2 or 3 years ago, the tax division realized that motorcycles were under this and notified the few small businesses in the state who were renting motorcycles that they were going to be charged this tax. Motorcycles, like RVs, are more expensive to rent than are passenger vehicles, the other rental cars. And so this is putting a fairly heavy burden. When you rent a motorcycle, it can be easily $200 a day. And people who come up to do this will often rent them for several times, several days or weeks at a time. Unlike rental cars, where you can put all members of your family in one car, if you rent a motorcycle, you generally rent one for each member of the family. So if you're making a family vacation of it, this adds up very, very quickly. And you'll hear testimony shortly, I believe, from somebody in the state who's renting these, and will explain the kinds of negative impacts this has had on their attempt to promote small business in the state. People who come up here on motorcycles ride around the state. They stay in hotels. They eat in restaurants. So we would like to help this business grow. What this bill would do is it would exempt the motorcycles from that definition of passenger vehicle, thereby eliminating the tax on the rental of motorcycles in Alaska.
Thank you, Representative.
With that, I'm happy to take any questions, or James Waldo's happy to take any questions.
I'll start with one. How do municipalities, which also have vehicle rental taxes, treat motorcycles for this purpose?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to defer to Mr. Waldo on this.
Mr. Chairman, James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes. That is not a question we have an answer to at this time, but it is certainly a question we can get you an answer to. And additionally, I think Nancy Hull, who rents motorcycles and does this as her business and does that in Anchorage, I believe, should know the answer to that question, at least as far as Anchorage is concerned, sir.
I've never heard whether the munis have or not, and we had this bill last year, and I didn't think to ask it then. And
Mr. Chairman, we honestly haven't heard that question before, so we hadn't looked into it.
And the amount, just for purpose, before I go to Representative Thompson, this has a finance referral. I guess, have you talked to our tax division about the cost of collecting this $12,000 tax?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we have. Do we have them online to talk to that? I mean, there was discussion because, as you noted, the fiscal note is it's a $12,000 proposed reduction in revenue per year, which is the amount they've been collecting. Obviously, it does cost money to collect, to prepare and collect that. And so there was discussion at one point about simply lowering the tax to a lower amount. But at that point, you're collecting so little money, you're spending more in.
It was the judgment of this committee that
I believe that. It was the judgment of this committee that very intelligently figured out that it was probably going to cost more to collect the tax than there would be recovered. And you are correct, Mr. Chairman, that was
even
the right idea of this committee.
Even a pig finds a truffle once in a while.
And I believe we have Ms. Bales from the tax division.
We'll come back to that, and that's we dealt with this issue on the gravel extraction, and even more so the auditing requirements of trying to deal with government is probably even, I'm more concerned about that. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In fact, you asked my question, how much does it cost to collect the $12,000 that the state does annually? But I would like to make a statement that I can see where the economic impact of renting motorcycles would be very great, especially in the Juneau area. You would have a lot of sales of rain gear.
And I think the EMS folks would do a booming business. Representative Costello.
Brought back through the chair. The last time I talked to somebody on a cross-country motorcycle trip was in, I think, your district at the Hilltop Cafe outside of Fox or something near Fairbanks, and the man was videotaping his entire trip, and it was very interesting. But my question actually is about, I think when we saw this bill before, we had information on what the cost is to rent a motorcycle, and I was curious if you could share that with the committee.
Representative Costello, through the chair, James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes. Again, I don't rent motorcycles, so I'm not the expert, but as I've been told and as we've discussed with the folks who do this as a business, motorcycle rentals can cost anywhere between $100 to $250. So it's significantly more expensive than say, if you went to Avis and rented a Ford Taurus.
I believe Ms. Hall will have much to share us on this issue. Any other general questions before we go to our public testimony? Ms. Hall from Palmer, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello?
Yes, please. I know, unfortunately, you're familiar with this process because you've gone through it so many times, and hopefully this is the year we get this done.
Yeah, this is year number four for me. I wouldn't know what to do in February if I didn't talk to all you people. Anyway, I do have some testimony. And so good afternoon, Honorable Chairman Osterman and Honorable Chairman Stoltz. Thank you for scheduling House Bill 56 and providing me the opportunity to provide support for this bill. For the record, my name is Nancy Hull. That's H-U-L-L. I am the friendly and non-confrontational motorcyclist, and I'm also the owner of Alaska Motorcycle Adventures. We are in Palmer, Alaska. We've been renting motorcycles since 1994, so this will be our 20th year renting in Alaska. I do support the House Bill 56 to exclude motorcycles from the 10% vehicle rental tax because of those unintended consequences of the tax. And to offset the high vehicle rental tax, our customers choose to rent for fewer days, or they pass on coming to Alaska altogether, and that hurts all of our tourism when they pass altogether. So I'll just give you an example. You know, in our 90-day season, we do have high rates. We average around $200 a day, so our customers paying $20 a day in tax. You know, on a rental of 10 days, that's $200 in tax. And where it is very punitive is where a couple or a husband, wife, father, son come and rent two motorcycles, doubling that to $400 tax. And last year I had one father bring three sons, and their rental tax was over $700 for their six-day ride, which is very punitive. And there's no tax cap to help these folks out, like, okay, you pay $300 and you're done. Okay, so the nice thing is that our customers do ride to all the remote areas of the state because our motorcycles will get them there. So you have people in Wiseman and Circle, Chicken, McCarthy, Valdez, Dead Horse, and they support those areas by using the hotels and restaurants and all the other services. They also have to ride through Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Mat-Su to get to these areas. So they're spending money everywhere, which is, I think, what we want to do to encourage the tourism. So I'm asking you to help me and the other local operators. We have Keith Payne in Fairbanks with Alaskan Adventure Riders, and we also have Phil Freeman with MotoQuest Tours in Anchorage, and then also the Harley dealership in Anchorage also rents bikes. So you got three operators operating out of Anchorage and one out of Fairbanks. In this, when I think back to 2003, which is a long time ago, I was renting motorcycles, And when this bill was written, unfortunately, they just didn't know we existed. And it's been a long, time-consuming process to change that omission in the discussion at that time. So I ask for your support, possibly your co-sponsorship of House Bill 56. So this time and this year, we pass this so that I don't have to call you folks again next year. If you have any detail or need any more detail, I'd be glad to offer that. And I thank you so much for your valuable time, your consideration, and also just helping me grow my business and every other tourism business in the state. Thank you.
Ms. Hull, do you know if the municipalities, you're probably in, are you within the city of Palmer? I'm trying to remember where you're at.
Yeah, actually, I operate in my business out of Anchorage, but I am familiar with the Anchorage municipality. They do not consider motorcycle passenger vehicles, so there is no tax for the municipality of Anchorage.
Depends
on. And if you gave me like a half an hour, I could find that number of
sure.
the code. I used to have it in my notes. It's very much buried at this point.
You never know if these union contracts get too far out of hand. They might have to come after you there.
No,
we'll leave that there.
Yes, remember, I'm the friendly non-confrontational motorcyclist.
Yeah. Non-confrontational. And if you were operating, are you on Spinard Road there then?
No. That's my competitor. We actually operate out of the motorcycle shop on Potter Drive. And everybody, we go to the airport, pick up the people, bring them in, get them on the bike. And so it's a very smooth operation for us.
So we're probably talking about less, the whole industry at $12,000, probably less than 1,000 motorcycle days of rentals.
Yeah, it is pretty limited. It is a very limited, with 90 days, I'd have to look at what my numbers were for last year, but it's so small. And, you know, we're very much mom-and-pop shops, every one of us. I know Keith Payne in Fairbanks, him and his wife, they run the whole business themselves. For my husband and I, we basically take care of the motorcycles. Our teenage daughters, college-age daughters, and their friends wash the motorcycles. So we are very much family business. Kind of the same thing for Phil Freeman. His operation has grown to do some tours. They are a little bit bigger, but it's very limited business. You have to love motorcycling to be doing this.
Thank you. Do you have any, you even have an estimate of what you spend on complying with bookkeeping and accounting for your small business? There has to be a cost, whether it's a... How many hours you spend?
I can't even begin to calculate what that cost is for me. I do all of the accounting for our business, and it's a lot of it is explaining the tax to the customers, and also
that you're charging it, not you're collecting it, not charging it, right?
Yes, I am collecting it. It is added to every invoice that I have, and then forwarding that to the Department of Revenue when I have collected it. One of the unfortunate things is they have reporting four times a year, so I have to report on December 31st and March 31st of each year, even though there are absolutely no rentals. It's the way the Department of Revenue has the vehicle rental tax structured. I'm writing a zero report twice a year, which is kind of unfortunate.
Nobody in here knows about reporting.
Oh, I know.
Are there any questions for Ms. Hull? Because I just wanted to know before we sent it to Representative Thompson's subcommittee. I'm just kidding, Nancy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, and stay online in case any other questions come up, but I doubt you're going to leave anyway.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Matt Fonder from the Tax Division. Are you there, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
What do you have an estimate of what it costs you to administer this tax, Mr. Fonder?
Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, I do not. We just have one individual who works with the vehicle rental tax here with the tax division, and that covers all of the vehicle rental tax, so it includes RVs, motor vehicles, motorcycles, et cetera. So it's hard to break that out and specify how much time that one person really spends on motorcycles, but obviously it's a small portion compared to motor vehicles and RVs.
Any questions while Mr. Fonder is online? Okay. Is there? Thank you very much, Mr. Fonder. Is there anybody else wishing to testify on the bill? The public, from the bureaucracy, from points that we can't see? Go ahead and close the public testimony. Are there any amendments to this otherwise flawless bill? I think we've discussed the fiscal note already. It is a Representative Munoz.
I would offer a motion to move the bill if you're ready for that.
Here, well, just right after we get the, there are, we, there is the fiscal note. We'll note that it has the $12,000 potential change in revenue. We don't know that that actually, we may lose that anyway if it becomes so economic to offer a business, operate a business. So, all lots of things related to taxes could be affected. So. That Representative Munoz reflecting
thank
that $12,000 fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House Bill 56, Version A, with the attached fiscal note, and ask for unanimous consent.
Are there any objections? The House Bill 56 will be moved out of committee with the Department of Revenue fiscal note, with your ability to reflect your support, neutrality, or opposition to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the committee.
Great. We will take a brief at ease. Finance come back to order after a very brief at ease. It's 2:59. We have one last bill on our docket today. That's House Bill 21, and we have today with us the House Majority Whip and Transportation Chair to present House Bill 21.
Thank you, co-chairs, Representative Stoltz and Representative Osterman, and other members of the Finance Committee. Thank you for hearing the bill today. And for the record, my name is Representative Peggy Wilson, District 33. House Bill 21 will allow a rural school district to implement a four-day school week. Now, this is a pilot program, and it will sunset in 3 years. And this bill provides that the district must provide students with the equivalent of a five-day school week in those 4 days. The district must prove and include support from affected students, teachers, parents, and the community that everyone has been included in this decision and that the majority are in favor of the four-day school week. The school district must file an annual report to compare the performance ratings of the district both before and after the change to the four-day week. This is to ensure that students are benefiting from the change. This report will be submitted to the legislature and to the Commissioner of Education. I believe that this pilot program will be helpful to try in our rural Alaska because it will allow Alaska to gather data to continue to evolve our schools and determine that if we are doing everything that we can to assist those rural districts in achieving academic excellence while responding to the changing needs of the 21st century. House Bill 21 allows students to work if necessary to help their family. It will allow students to travel for sports and other activities without missing an additional day of school. It will allow students and teachers to go to medical or dental appointments without missing school, because since there's not often doctors or dentist offices in those rural villages or communities. It allows times for teachers to get professional development without the loss of student-teacher contact hours. House Bill 21 allows time for rural students, parents and the teachers to do their subsistence hunting and gathering. But most of all, in the rural areas, we hope to see more academic progress in those districts. Now, there are 22 other states that already have implemented a four-day week in varying degrees and for varying reasons. This equates to about 120 school districts across the United States, and in just the last 2 years, there have been numerous new schools and districts considering going to this four-day school week. Colorado is an example when I said for various reasons. Colorado mainly did it to save money. And when Colorado did it, they actually saved money on fuel because they have quite harsh winters. And so they saved money on fuel. And not only that, but they saved 20% on their pupil transportation. All of the research that I have seen has been specifically for rural schools. I believe it really can be a fit for some of our rural schools. One of the most beneficial things that has been shown in the schools that have gone to a four-day week is it reduces absenteeism, not only in the students, but in the teachers. So I thought that was very interesting. And it also showed a very big increase in the morale of both the students and the teachers. So both of these items would be a huge benefit for our rural schools. I would like to just remind everyone that this pilot program is just that. It is a trial. It is an evolving program to gather data to see if it will work in Alaska. As our world is quickly changing around us, we need to be willing to try new ideas and improve the outcomes for students in various ways. Now, so really what this bill does, it allows flexibility and it maintains a local control, and it's another tool in their toolbox. So having said all that, there were a few points that came up during our last committee hearing in the last committee before bringing it to you today, and so I would like to mention those to you. It was brought to my attention that the State Board of Education only meets quarterly, and they would not meet again in time for a school to approve it for a school district to actually get this into action and going for a program to start this coming year. So the recommendation is to change the governing body back to the commissioner's office. In this vein, it was also suggested that the timeline for the commissioner to make this decision be short so that it can be put into effect this coming school year. And I recommend 10 days. Additionally, there would not be any comparative data that first year, because in the springtime is usually when those tests are given and they don't always have the results back by the end of the school year. And so we recommend to change the reporting to the legislature to be done only the second and third years, and that way they would have the results so that they would be able to tell you what those results would mean. And lastly, depending on how the district would configure the teacher days, their retirements could be jeopardized because their retirements are based on the number of days they work. And so when this goes down to four school days, then they're required to work 128 days or 180 days, I believe. And so that would be an easy fix by just changing some language. And this can be done by, quote, adding an approved alternative schedule that meets the hours necessary and can replace the day requirement. And so that's just, because right now our retirement, in the retirement system, it says teachers have to work so many days. And so we need to think about saying, okay, equivalent hours so that the days that they work, because they're going to be working longer, those 4 days are going to be longer hours. So anyway, having said all that, I welcome any questions from the committee.
Representative Stella. Oh,
thank you, Representative Wilson. I appreciate you bringing forward a bill. I find it very interesting, and I have a bunch of questions, but I'll try to narrow them down to just the ones that
I just might want to interject at some point. Would it be helpful to bring up the commissioner at the same time so there might be some of playing back and forth? Or what's your preference, Representative Wilson?
Well, that would be fine.
I think there may be some that if you have a bunch of questions, let's have
and I also
your old like principal up here.
My aide on this is Sherry Klein, and she.
Why don't Ms. Klein? Why don't you join us too? That was my next question I had. Is whether you let's rather than you having to ask somebody up later.
Thank you. One of the things I was curious about is oftentimes the state will do a pilot program because we're investing money, and we want to know if we're getting a good return on our investment. And in this case, there's no fiscal note, so I was curious, first of all, why would we limit this to one rural school district and not allow just those who are interested to pursue this?
And I would be open to more than just one. It just doesn't say that, but I would be open to that.
Mm-hmm. I'd
like to follow up if from a policy point, if the commissioner might have a reason why you might want to stick your toe in the water instead of jumping in. If you don't mind me intruding.
No, sure.
For the record, Mike Hanley, I'm the commissioner for the Department of Education. Is the question,
her question.
About why a pilot as opposed to just implementing a program?
Yes.
Currently, what's in statute in 14030 allows the commissioner to allow a four-day week. So what we have in place right now is currently available. Since I've been commissioner, I've only had one request for that. I would have the ability, I do believe, to make that a pilot if I chose to do so. Even if I didn't, I think if I were to allow a four-day week, I think that it would... part of our responsibility as a state, as a Department of Education, is to provide oversight and support. And so I think oversight in any program, whether it's a pilot or not, would be necessary. So I'm not concerned about a pilot versus just a straightforward program.
Thank you, Chair. So then what we're doing, I guess, Representative Wilson, is because it's a pilot, we would just be getting the information back. And that information is what we're interested in, is to see if this somehow garners results that we like. Is that true?
Yes. And actually, the school district in my new district that I have now asked for that last year to the commissioner, and they didn't get it, and so they came to me and said, would you do it? And the superintendent it wasn't his idea, it wasn't the school's idea. The parents of the students and the school board came to the school and said, we want a four-day school week. Mm-hmm. And I do admit that what happened was they didn't know. They asked the commissioner, and the commissioner said no, and so they said to the commissioner, he asked several questions, and they said, well, we don't want to go to all that trouble unless we know you're going to let us do it, and so it kind of stopped there, and because he said no, and so that's where we're at, and so I wanted to get it going because I think this school district actually has very good scores. It's one of the top rural school districts in the state as far as scores go. And so I thought it would be good, and it might work in some areas, but I wanted to for us as legislators to be able to see, how will it work? Let's just see what some of the facts are after 3 years, and if it's a go, then we'll feel more comfortable, and I think the commissioner will feel more comfortable in allowing it in other schools.
Mr. Chair?
We'll go a couple more, and then we'll go to a couple other members.
And I wanted to point out in our packet, there's a report from Denise Juno from Montana, and on page 9 she mentions the other surrounding states that have, in the region, that have gone to a four-day school as an option. And one of the things I wanted to point out, which I find interesting, is that they find in the results that attendance improves, dropout rates improve, but that student achievement, there's no effect on student achievement. And I was wondering, Representative Wilson, if you were hopeful that we would see different results, or if you could comment on that portion of this report.
Yes, I actually hope that we will see, even though this school is one of the top schools, I hope we will see an improvement. Because if there is, it might be a way that we can see improvements if we try it in some of the other rural schools. But I think there's a lot of things that have to be in place. I don't think this can be willy-nilly. I think it's got to be well planned out, but I think it could happen if the right scenario was available.
And one final question through the chair.
Right, and yeah, this final question, and we're gonna just have one question from each person. I'm looking at the clock. I've got two subcommittees, one starting at 3:30 in this very room. So we'll go, and there are some people that flew in that are in town. So we'll take this very quick round of short questions and then go to the public testimony.
And in the sponsor statement, you mentioned the majority of the community would have to support this. When you say that, does that mean the voting public or the community within the school building?
Not the vote. I mean the parents, the teachers, the community, and the school board. They all it has to have a buy-in, I think, from everybody in the area, because if they don't, they aren't going to be able to succeed in it. You know, because they have to have make sure that the kids do go to school those 4 days, and if the parents aren't willing to make sure the kids go to school, then it's not going to be worth trying, I think. So that I think it has to have buy-in from everybody.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson, then Guerra, then Osterman, and then we'll go to the public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over the last couple of years, I read editorials and articles where a lot of European countries have gone to a six-day school week, and they've improved their grades where they're way ahead of the United States. So I'm curious to see how your feelings are about looking at a six-day instead of a four. Are we going to make some progress, and will this show us some statistics that maybe show we're doing the right thing?
You know, I really hadn't thought about a six-day school week, so I really can't answer that. But I hope that this gives us some data that we can make some decisions with.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Representative Wilson, I didn't think about this when you came by my office, and I appreciate you coming by the office. But just to grant schools more flexibility, let's say you've got like the lower Kuskokwim school district and the people in Kwikset wanted to do it, but the people in Bethel didn't want to do it. The way the bill is written, I think it's like the whole school district has to do it. So would you mind language that would allow one or more schools within the school district to do this, just in case not every school in the school district wanted to do it? And the other one would be like, for example, maybe some community would want to do it in high school because the kids can come home from high school and their parents can still work but might not want to do it in elementary school. So what about language that would say one or more schools within the school district? Would you have a problem with that?
I wouldn't have a problem with that. And that's why this works better in rural areas than in the urban areas, because in the rural areas there's not very many homes where both parents work, and so when the kids come home they're not by themselves. But in an urban area there's more chance for more parents that are both working. And but I actually, in the school that is wanting to do this, one of the schools is not going to.
Thank you. Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, did you say that you have the authority right now to do this program?
Through the chair, yes, I do. Essentially, as the bill is written here, and not to include the suggested changes that were referenced, the bill here labeled N, for 30 days, it changes the authority to approve a four-day week from the commissioner to the state board. And adds a couple of these components about the reporting requirements. That's essentially the difference. Although during that 30 days, I could still offer a four-day week or approve a four-day week. So if changes were made, that they would be reflected as per Representative Wilson's comments. But as it's written, it's basically a 30-day window for one district for the school board to make the decision instead of myself.
Yeah, please. And one school district asked for it, and if I understood the conversation there, that you turned it down.
Through the chair, that's correct. And what Representative Wilson referred to is correct. They had come to me without a plan for the most part. They said, we really want to do this. Our parents want to do this. And I looked at the statute, and I said, well, I can approve an acceptable plan, that equals an equivalent of a five-day week. And the conversation we had was, well, I'm not going to go through all that work until I know I've got it. And I said, well, we're kind of in a quandary because I need to have it to approve it. I need to know what's being proposed. And so that's where it kind of stopped. So that was why the denial. I didn't have a proposal before me that I thought met the requirements.
Please.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to, in the interest of making sure we hit a lot of the people that are here to testify, we'll ask the sponsors to clear the table and the commissioner. Yeah. And I'd like to ask Wanda Laws if she'd wish to testify. She signed up. Okay. Bruce Johnson.
I'm located right here in Juneau, so I'm willing to defer my time since I'll be able to come.
Okay. And Ron Fuhrer from NEA Alaska. We're going to keep the public testimony open. This is one of broad policy interests, so there, people may not know about this issue yet.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Ron Fuhrer, and I serve as president of NEA Alaska, representing approximately 13,000 public school employees and retirees throughout Alaska. As this is my first time speaking to the House Finance Committee, I wanted to give you a brief background. I've taught in Alaska for over 30 years, including 26 at Clark Middle School and the past four at McLaughlin. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 21. NEA Alaska would like to thank Representative Peggy Wilson and the co-sponsors for bringing this legislation forward. Every January, about 400 NEA Alaska delegates elected by the 13,000 members meet in what we call our Delegate Assembly. The Delegate Assembly last month established six principles, including creating opportunities for innovative practices. We believe through House Bill 21, a community, a school district, parents, and students can work together to pilot a four-day school week and determine if the idea can work. Thank you for allowing me the time to share this testimony on behalf of NEA Alaska members. And I look forward to House Bill 21 moving from the House Finance Committee and through the legislative process. And I don't know why I'm running out of breath.
I'd like to acknowledge Representative Peggy Wilson is a sponsor, and we have what's called a prime sponsor. Representative Tammy Wilson is a prime sponsor, and Representative Tompkins from Sitka, all three are prime sponsors. They have some kind of equal weight in this process. So. And all equal involvement. Thank you. Do you see this having any effects on, given the going from 5 to 4 hours, on any negotiation issues, overtime issues? And would those be a potential issue that, given that you represent 13,000 some people?
I believe that it's a local control issue, and I think that whatever they can work together on, I think is a good thing.
You anticipate you wouldn't see NEA or Totem or pushing issues of overtime? I guess you speak with total certainty on that, sir?
Yes.
Okay. I wish we could hold that, but any questions? Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Lauren Birch, testifying remote from Thorn Bay.
Yes, sir. This is Lauren Birch, Superintendent, Southeast Island School District, based in Thorn Bay. I'd be available for questions. I'm aware of the time, and you're trying to get to other things as well.
We do have
a couple
time
comments
have
on
comments.
Things that that were said is in terms of people being involved in the choice. We have the local school advisory council. And the way those are set up at each of our nine different schools, anybody that comes to those meetings can vote. I mean, there's plenty of public comment or opportunity for people to come, and whether it's community member, parent, Even students can vote on issues, and you know, it's very local control, and we give that opportunity. We also, it was sort of commented too, we have one or more of our nine schools that will opt to stay with 5-day, and we've found a way to make that work as well. You know, we think it ought to be a school choice, like virtually everything else with education in Alaska. That
can you repeat that term again?
Give it a try.
What was that term you used? School what?
School choice.
Okay. Oh, please. I had a bad ear here.
Oh, I have a bad voice. Well, thank you. I'll if there are questions, otherwise I'll. Representative Peggy Wilson did a very fine job talking about it already. Thank you.
Representative Tammy Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the superintendent brought up one of those points, is that all the schools, even within a district, can go to 4 or 5 days. Could one of the options also be, superintendent, that if they didn't want to go longer days, that you could actually extend the weeks if the school decided that was best for their children?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I suppose so. As soon as I start extending days and hours, now I do have a union problem. And I'd be curious of NEA's opinion on that. But, you know, if we start going to, you know, somebody wants to go to 6 days, you know, there is a cost with that. Thank you.
No, what I meant is that you could actually extend the weeks so that you still be going 4 days, but you would, instead of having longer days, you could have more weeks. But that may, I'll talk to the NEA to get there on that. Thank you.
Well, I do remember them saying it's a local issue, but the funding is a state issue. So that's how I interpreted that. The negotiations will be on the local issue, and that's correct. As of today, the state doesn't negotiate contracts for school district employees as of today. But I think Mr. Furr was correct. It is a local issue, and that's the bargaining units and the assemblies, and we're seeing some of that going on in Anchorage. So I think he was correct, and it is a local issue, but the funding seems to always be a state issue. That's my interpretation. Representative Wilson?
And Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure we've heard comments about longer days and what that does to children. And I just want to back to, it is local control. When we talk about 4-day school, it's about the hours that the children put in. It doesn't necessarily, a school district could, depending upon, you know, their unions, choose to go more weeks and actually do a year-round type of program if that was their choice, because really it's about how many hours in that school year. But I just want to make sure that it's not necessarily about longer days, it's about choice.
I would just the three sponsors of the bill, Representative Wilson, and Tompkins, might ask the municipality of Anchorage what financial ramifications a contract involving a shift from a 4-day work week to a 5-day work involving a law enforcement union, how many millions of dollars that costs the municipality of Anchorage. So that is a local issue. So something we should go into this eyes wide open. Should a district decide that, you know, from a 4 to a 5 week, we have, that's you can call it apples and oranges, but we had a issue, and Representative Holmes and Representative Costello and Representative Guerra live in that municipality. I believe it was in the multi-millions of dollars for a couple hundred employees. So, eyes wide open. Are there any other folks? Mr. Johnson, we do have a couple of minutes here. We will keep the record open, but since you're here.
For the record, I'm Bruce Johnson, the Executive Director for the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Thank you for this opportunity. Our association wants to lend our support to House Bill 21. We like the idea of choice where that is possible. This has emerged from an individual district and now has become much larger than just an individual district, perhaps, if we eliminate the pilot. The pilot made sense to our membership, that you start out slowly, get it figured out, and then you expand from there. But clearly, Representative Wilson and others have pointed out some important issues that, and it's clear that this isn't decided today, that there's an opportunity for some adjustments, and we'll be back to listen in and assist if we can. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, as a school administrator on the financial end, do you have any cautionaries on negotiations and how changes of work schedules can affect those?
Mr. Chairman, it would be my sense that those things would have to be dealt with at the local level within the law that currently exists.
The impact, Mr. Johnson, as a school, as a representative of those school administrators, do you think there are any concerns that people should have about these as negotiation or bargaining issues?
Mr. Chairman,
it is a local level, but we're making laws that affect municipalities.
Absolutely. There is should be concern. They need to be figured out. Attorneys will be involved. Collective bargaining will take place, all of those things. But we recognize what's being proposed here is the total number of hours that young people are in school and the total number of hours that people are required to work. And if you can get some flexibility within that and negotiate that, I think it can work, but it has to be in writing.
That's Representative Wilson.
Yeah, and you do realize, though, through the chair, that the four-day school week, whether this bill goes forward or not, is still available, not as a pilot project, but you know, districts can still apply for that through the commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, and we were supportive of the commissioner doing that, and we were involved with our district that was proposing this idea, which is novel for us in Alaska right now.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Guerra?
It's not really directed to the sponsors. I just want to make sure that your bill, which only allows this to happen in one school district, doesn't somehow limit the Board of Education's ability to allow it in more than one district. So I'll trust that you'll make sure the language doesn't actually go backwards and take that away. But it probably has. I haven't looked at it that closely.
Absolutely. We'll take care of your concerns in your office.
We'll take care of them in the committee. So we don't like people making policy decisions in office, right?
Oh, sorry, sir. I just been answering his question. No policy going on in office. I'm sorry.
I didn't want to get Representative Guerra in trouble. Well, I appreciate the public testimony on this. We'll keep the public testimony open because I think there's a lot of active questions still on this bill, and we want to have a very inclusive process. So we will set this bill aside for additional consideration and deliberation. Thank everybody for their input on this bill. Representative Osterman, Mr. Co-Chair.
There will be no meeting tomorrow. We will meet here at 1:30 on Monday, the 4th of March. We will be taking up HB 65, which is the appropriation budget, and the House will have House Bill 66, the appropriation mental health budget. They will have a CS, and it'll be introduced and adopted, and then we'll look at public hearings and amendments from there on out. Chairman.
Chief Gavel, so.
Anything else from anybody? We are adjourned.